It's time for a tip-worthy edition of On Your Money, Financial Planner. Kevin McKinley is chock full of tips today, including tips on tipping. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8.5 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, November the 29th. We will talk about tipping, and we will talk about shopping for computer tablets, and we will ponder this question: are you a dinosaur if you pay by check? And Kevin will ponder all of your personal finance questions, too. Call us if you have one at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. And he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Joy.
Did you have a wonderful Thanksgiving?
I had a wonderful Thanksgiving. I was there right away at midnight Friday morning.
I bet you were.
Doing all my... I actually don't go at that time to buy things. That's when I go to make my returns of things I bought during the previous year. And
that's a good time to go, yeah.
Yeah, and I found out a couple things, good tips for people next year who've never been there. When they say it's a doorbuster sale... they really don't want the door busted.
No, they don't like that.
Not on purpose. If it happens by accident, so be it. But no, how about you? Did you have a good Thanksgiving?
I did. I had a lovely Thanksgiving. I also did not go to the doorbuster sales. But yeah, there's a lot going on there. Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, Cyber Monday yesterday. And I am, I'm going to look forward to later in the show when you take us shopping for iPads, Nooks, and Kindles, and the like in our shop around segments. So I need to find out more about these items, maybe on a Christmas list. You don't know. But let's talk about tipping. Are we supposed to tip our financial planner?
It's always good cause, and I have a jar right on my desk where after providing adequate financial advice, I have a dollar or two. It's more the gesture, but it all adds up.
You got a tip jar.
Several dozen clients, right.
Well, the holiday season is the time when we think about tipping, but I'm always a little confused as to who to figure out who I should tip, how much I should tip. You have some suggestions?
Yeah, by default, you know, if you just kind of want to be like Elvis and hand out $100 bills wherever you see someone doing something nice for you or someone mm-hmm. else, it's not many people will complain except maybe your husband. But a few bucks can be a big deal and can make or break an important relationship. Most importantly, this is just a way of saying thank you for all that you've done for me during the year. And obviously, I'm, you know, paying you or paying for your service, but anyone with whom you have a regular, familiar relationship, especially someone with whom you're making an appointment on a regular basis, like cleaning person, lawn care, hair care, babysitter, newspaper carrier even. A lot of people don't get the newspaper delivered via paper form now, so then you just tip your cable company. Just put an extra $5 bill in your bill next time. And it really is somewhat about the money, but it's also about remembering and recognizing their service. But it can be a little awkward, not only trying to figure out what is a decent amount, but actually how to get the money to the person.
Yeah, well, what is a decent amount?
Typically, a rule of thumb is the cost of the visit. So let's say, you know, I get my hair permed and colored every single week.
It's very nice,
and,
by the way.
Yeah, it looks great on me. And so if you pay $20 for a hair care appointment, a $20 tip at the end of the year is a nice, suitable tip. 10 to 20% is normally the tipping, obviously, the range that you give for a server. So $10 to $20 for any type of appointment that you get, up to $50, and you're kind of pushing it. But garbage workers, $10 and $20. The postal workers, by the way, have a very official policy that postal carriers cannot accept gifts of cash and can't accept any gifts greater than $50 during the year. So if you are going to give something to the postal worker, you might want to give a gift card that can't be used for cash or an item that that might be of value to them. But if you give something to the postal worker, keep in mind that he or she is going to have to carry that gift mm-hmm. on their route until they get back to the truck again.
No Advils or whatever they're called. there's some salons, though, for example, mine, say no tipping.
Right, and that's you hope that 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 would mean that they're actually paying their people more, or maybe even charging people more. We've included the price of a gratuity in the cost of a gratuity into the price, so that they're actually still making the money that they would. I would still check with the manager and say, is that serious, or can I do this for a year end, or what can I do for a nice gesture? Or you can, you know, send a box of cookies over or something to the staff that they can do. If you can't find some of the workers, though, you know, like, you don't know if your service worker for your garbage route is actually the same one every single week, or it's, you know, you don't want to leave a $20 bill taped to the garbage can.
Right.
Contact the office, ask them about their policy on tips, like your hair care place, and then the best way to make sure that the money gets to the person who serves you, it might be by sending a little note with a card and a check made out to the person so it doesn't get skimmed before it actually reaches the person, or a gift card that's included in a thank you card as well.
Well, here's a sensitive topic, though, Kevin. A lot of us are struggling this year to make ends meet. Maybe we want to thank these people in our lives, but we really don't have the cash to do so.
Yeah, you're the one hoping for the tips rather than doling them out. You can still pick up I believe there's an antiquated device. It's called a pen and a piece of paper or a card of some kind, and just write a note to the person. Say, I really appreciate all that you've done, and thank you very much for it. You can also take a little more time and write something that's even more useful, like a letter of recognition for the person to the supervisor, saying, I just want to tell you that this person's done a really great job for me all year, and I hope that you take this into account and put it in her file. And then finally, you can just write a note to the person and say, you know what, you are really good at what you do, and I really appreciate your attitude and your work ethic and how helpful you are. If you ever move on in life and you need a reference of some sort, here's my contact information. Call me first to make sure I know who you are, but put me down as a reference if you're applying for a job in the future.
Should we be tipping those more at the end of the year, even if we've been providing tips year-round?
I believe yes. Most of the people whom we're giving money, especially in a retail setting, by definition, they're not making a whole lot of money, and it's hopefully not their career work. And if it is, they need the tips as much as they possibly can. So please leave a dollar or two on the counter. Say, keep the change. Even if you have, 10 of these interactions during the week and you leave an extra dollar, it's $500 a year, a buck a weekday, let's say. It's not a whole lot of money to you compared to what it is likely to be to this worker, especially if every one of their customers leaves an extra dollar or so. So just take a dollar in, drop it off there, and leave it over. Tell them to keep the change. And then if people say, oh, no, sir, you forgot your dollar, not only do you get the credit with the individual, but the entire place, the whole coffee shop, sees you saying, no, keep the change. And you walk out of there in a little higher esteem, I think, than of the rest of the clientele.
Well, if you have a question about tipping over the holidays or another personal finance question, we welcome your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. You should consult with your own financial advisor prior to making any investment decisions. And it is time for the On Your Money email bag, where Lori writes, I am retired with a $24,000 annual income. I have a stock account worth about $300,000. My son can't afford his $1,800 a month mortgage payment, and $210,000 is still owed. Their credit is too poor for them to refinance. Should I use my stock account to pay off the mortgage? It's their inheritance.
Wow, that's a serious issue and a very serious question. Was there any false praise included in that email?
No, I didn't. Sorry.
Okay, well then we'll answer it anyway because it is a dire situation, especially when you're talking about family members for whom you want to provide. And obviously, according to Lori, this is going to be their money someday when Lori's gone. So the question is how can she help them best right now? And I do think that cashing in any type of liquid assets, especially when it's really the lion's share of what it sounds like for her financial portfolio. Cashing in all of that to pay off the mortgage and relieve her son from this pretty big mortgage payment. That's the last resort if it should happen at all. It uses up almost all of her money. And if he can't get other income in, he still might have to sell the house. And it still might create a bigger financial problem down the road. There are much better alternatives if she ever gets to this point. And again, I'm saying she should only use it as a last resort and maybe not use it at all.
All right. Then where should she start?
Well, one thing she could do is if she has $24,000 a year coming in, she has $2,000 a month, plus she has a stock account, I would much rather have someone in this situation slowly pull $1,800 a month out of the savings just to keep him current on his mortgage payment for a while so that he can hopefully get some other income or figure out how to sell the house or get out from under this mortgage. So that only costs $1,800 a month versus $300,000 or $200,000 all at one shot.
Yeah, a little more reasonable. But what if he can't get back on his feet?
If she still wants to help him keep the house, she should see if they can go in together back to the bank and refinance the mortgage at a new lower interest rate and do it as a cosigner. It still doesn't use up her money. She might have to kick in a little bit as a down payment, but it will hopefully not only lower his payment, but then again, if he comes back and starts struggling again, she can help make the payment and keep it going. Now, if she cosigns for the new loan, he's going to be able to probably get better terms, but she is going to be potentially liable for that loan if he cannot make it, in which case she'd probably have to either default on the home or use her savings to pay off the mortgage.
So what would you say if Lori still decides to give him the money so the mortgage can be paid off?
Well, with family, a lot of times people, and especially these are people who are very well-meaning and mean well and want to help their kids out, there's sometimes a hesitation to actually use legal documents because it seems like, you know, you're being rude or you're accusing the person of not being able to, their word is no good. It's still much better to have paper in place that documents exactly what's taking place, that this is a loan to him, that it's secured by the home. Lori may want to actually buy the home for herself and rent it back to him until he can buy it back from her, or she may want to sell it to him with a land contract so that she knows that if for whatever reason he can't make the payments, she still has some equity in the home that she can use to hopefully not ruin her retirement.
And Kevin, what if she just wants to? I think she's saying this is the money she would give her son as an inheritance. Can she just give the inheritance early?
In theory, yes, yeah. She can give it to him. I don't think this is a very good idea at all for many reasons, but she can give it to him. She may have to file a gift tax return to avoid paying gift taxes, but that's usually the matter of a little bit of paperwork. But having a paid-for home and really still probably not being in great financial shape by definition of his situation, and then her cash being completely gone, the last thing they want to have is having their only asset be this paid-for home.
That makes sense. Marty in Douglas County is our first caller. Hi, Marty.
Well, good morning.
Morning.
And because I've listened to the show a lot, you know, of all the financial planners named Kevin who you have on your show, Joy, this one is my favorite.
That's
for
wonderful,
sure in the
Marty.
Top two. I got to be in the top two.
I just realized, Kevin, there are two.
Oh. There's a huge pool from which to draw.
So, oh, what are the chances of that? Well, at the risk of sounding like a goody two-shoes, I'm wondering if it's a bad thing to not have any debt. My husband and I, we have been together for 30 years. We're both artists, and except for a 10-year period where he had a part-time job, we have never known month-to-month how much money we're making. And so because of that fear factor, we have we've paid off our house. We paid off our house right away. We own the two vehicles that we have. We have another little house in New Mexico that we paid off right away. I pay for everything with my credit card because I get miles, airline miles, but at the end, you know, when we get the bill, that gets paid off completely. Is it bad to not have any debt? At this point in my life, I'll be 60 next year. I can't believe I'm saying that.
You don't have to say it. Make up whatever number you want to, Marty. We'll believe you. We have no choice but to take your word for it. I don't think it's a case of where it's bad to not have any debt. I think it's bad to have your net worth tied up in things that it's very difficult to liquidate in an emergency and causes a lot of stress if you should do so. Now, do you have retirement accounts or savings?
I take it no.
Well, we do have some savings. Yes, we do.
Okay, mm-hmm. Okay. That's and it's still, if nothing goes wrong, which I hope it won't, and it probably won't, this is still a better way to go of your choice in life because you are not paying interest costs. But if something should go wrong, generally by the nature of the situation, it's very difficult to go back and get money, extract cash back out of these paid for assets at that time. Banks don't want to lend to people who really need money, and so they're not going to give you a new mortgage likely, especially on your artist's wages. They are going to be very hesitant to give you the money because they don't want to have to sell the house if and when you default on the loan. And so then that means you have to sell the house. Well, if you sell the house, you're selling it in forgive the word, but a fire sale. So you're getting rid of it in a hurry, which means by definition you're going to get a very low price for it, and then you still have to figure out a place to live unless you move to New Mexico. And you're going to be doing all this, Marty, in the midst of a big crisis where you something else, usually health related, but something else is generating this great need for cash. So again, if everything is going to go fine, you probably will not run into trouble. It's only when you hit a bump in the road that's difficult to predict and plan for that you're going to run into trouble. So if you say, I still can't get any, I don't want to take out a new mortgage, at least see if you can get a home equity line of credit now against either or both of your homes so that if you have the home equity line of credit established, you can draw from it and then make the payment to keep the loan current and be able to stay in ownership and residence of both of your homes.
Okay. All righty. Home equity line of credit.
That's correct.
All right, Marty. Thanks very much. And Kevin, you'd agree that was probably the best call we've had from a listener named Marty from Douglas County.
So far, I mean, we've yeah. still got about 35 minutes here. That can always change. But I would definitely say for Marty, I would put her in the... I bet it'll be top five by the end of the day.
I do, too. And we will take more of your calls, whether you are named Marty or not, at 1-800-642-1234. If you have a question, a personal finance question that you would like Kevin to tackle, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money here on the Ideas Network. Give me some money. Give me some money. So, does anyone write checks anymore? And exploring Nooks and Kindles and the like, coming up on this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine, along with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley. And our next caller is Jay in Eastman. Hello, Jay.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is regarding my mother. She's going to be 70 here in about a week, so she will turn 70 and a half in 2012, and she's still working. She has a 401k. So my questions are, can she still contribute to that? And also, if she doesn't contribute, can she roll that over even if she's still working? Or maybe you can help me with what options she may have. Thank
sure.
you.
Yeah, Jay, quick question. The question is not maybe should she contribute to a 401k or can she, it's should she. She works, is it an hourly wage? Her income's very relatively low, I would guess?
Yeah.
Okay. Then she should actually not contribute to either an IRA or a 401k. She should contribute to a Roth IRA for herself, and she can contribute up to... $5,000, but since she's over 50 by about 20 years, she can contribute $6,000 per year or her earnings, whichever is less. And the reason that I would rather have her contribute to a Roth IRA is that any future distributions from the Roth IRA are tax-free. And since she's probably not paying much, if anything, in federal taxes right now, the tax break on the 401k or an IRA really doesn't help her out very much. So she can contribute and should contribute to a Roth IRA for herself. In terms of getting the money out, and you asked if she could roll it over to another provider, like out of her current 401k?
Correct. Yeah, if she's not going to contribute any longer, even though she's still working, can she roll that over?
Generally, yes, but it does depend on the terms of the actual employer agreement. Employers can set up all different kinds of either hurdles or holes for people to get at their money before they retire. Sometimes they say, you know, the only way you can get this out if you're still working is to take a hardship distribution, which is very difficult to do. Other times they say, no, once you've passed the age of 59 and a half, you can roll the money out into an IRA or something whenever you want to, even if you're still employed. So have her check with the employer provider and see what the documentation says. Somebody in HR should have the answer to that.
And she would still have to take her RMD, correct?
Yep, you still have to take your mandatory distributions from that, but usually those are going to be relatively small. It might be about 2 or 3% in the first year of the value. So even if it's, you know, $100,000, you might have to take $2,000 or $3,000 in the first year. And that does go up, but it goes up very gradually. So generally, it's not going to create a big problem for someone unless that person has a very, very large balance in their retirement account, which is a good problem to have.
Jay, thanks for the call. Hope that helps. Marianne in Menominee Falls is with us now. Hello, Marianne.
Morning.
Hi, Marianne.
Go ahead, Marianne.
I have a couple of questions. Because I am dissatisfied with the, I don't know what to call them, the people who are handling my money right now, all of my money is invested in one of those places. It's because my IRA, started by the company I worked for, was handled by them, and when I retired, everything went into that same group. But I have found that I am very dissatisfied. I would like to change to another one.
Oh, we're losing you, Marianne, but I think she wants to know if there's penalties or you know, fees or whatever if she wants to change from her place to something else.
Generally not. There might be some ancillary fees, like an account closing fee that might be, you know, $50 or $100, and there also might be a transfer fee in the same amount. And sometimes the new provider will actually reimburse Marianne for those fees. Where she may get hit, and I've seen this before, people say, I'm really disappointed with this investment account that I have, and I want to take it out. And what they were not aware of is that there's a surrender charge, meaning if you pull the money out of the investment, typically these show up in annuities, both fixed and variable, where if you pull the money out in the first year, they charge you 6% of the withdrawal and 5%, et cetera. And those terms can vary depending on the annuity provider and the company. So it's a good idea to just check with it. Yes, you can move an account, especially if it is an actual IRA. You can move that wherever you want, to any mutual fund company, any bank or credit union, any other insurance company, any financial advisor will generally take the IRA as long as the minimum amount meets their criteria. And then in terms of the actual fees, she just needs to check with the people, and they have to tell her and be honest with her and say there are no fees to pull this out, or it's going to cost you $X amount to pull this out if you take it. As long as she moves the money over in a custodian to custodian transfer, meaning the money is sent from one IRA holder to the next IRA holder to the new one, there'll be no tax liability for her whatsoever. She does not want to take a check for this if she can help it, and she definitely doesn't want to cash the check if the check is sent to her.
Marianne, thanks for the call. Sorry that we lost a connection. One more call in this segment. Sarah in Wisconsin Dells. Hello, Sarah.
Hello.
What's your question?
Well, I have been advised that I should think about putting some money in a traditional IRA because of our income situation this year and taxes. But I also perhaps need to investigate new health insurance, and I've been looking at health savings accounts, and I'm wondering if those two things have the same tax benefits, a traditional IRA and a health savings account.
When I'm able to clone myself, Sarah, and I have more time to investigate these things, I'm going to do a workup on this, because there is a really good case. If someone said, hey, look, I have the choice between putting money into a traditional IRA or getting a high deductible health insurance plan paired with an HSA. I only have $5,000 to put in the IRA or the HSA. Which one should I choose? Well, on the one hand, with the IRA, you get the tax deduction on the contribution, and you get a very wide variety, usually, of investment choices in it. With the health care savings account, you still get the tax break on the deposit generally, but you've also lowered your premiums. than you would if you had a very low deductible health insurance plan. And you get a little more freedom on how your health care dollars are not only invested in the HSA account, but how they're spent when they're pulled out. And since HSA, healthcare savings account, once you turn 65, they become IRAs anyway, there's probably a good case to be made that the HSA would be the preferred choice, especially in the short term, because of the savings you'll get with lower insurance premiums. So the only downside I see to doing that is the HSA has less investment options. You can't just pick any mutual fund. You typically have to stick with a few very isolated choices, and often those are very low risk choices, but they're very low return as well. So if you're planning on saving for retirement, the returns in the HSA probably won't make you very much money, especially relative to inflation. So if it were me and I only had a few thousand dollars to invest, I'd actually tilt towards the HSA, especially if I saw a big difference in the premium cost between what the high deductible plan charged and what a regular plan would charge.
Sarah, thank you very much for the call. We'll take more of your calls for Kevin McKinley in just a moment. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Time now for Smart Assets. And Kevin, you say it's a good time to review our retirement and estate planning and review an often overlooked component of estate planning. What's the overlooked component?
Yeah, if you can't remember the last time you checked who will get your money when you're gone, it's time to check who will get your money when you're gone. And this, of course, means updating or writing a new will, checking your life insurance, making sure there's enough of it, it's the right kind, and also looking at your retirement accounts like your IRAs and your 401ks and see whom you have designated as the beneficiary. This is a very important step because that designation can often supersede what you've put in your will or your trust, meaning if you said, I want one in your will, I want one person to get my retirement account, but then the retirement account itself actually has a different person on as the beneficiary, there's a good chance that the beneficiary on the retirement account will get the money, not whom you've designated in your will. That's the bad news. The good news is it's easy to change, but it's hard to undo it after you're gone. There are some things you can do with what they call post-mortem planning, but obviously you'll be dead, so your voice won't be heard at that time. We've got a few simple strategies and then some more sophisticated things you can look at as well.
You know, Kevin, this happened to someone I know, a good friend, many years ago, when a husband had his ex-spouse listed as the beneficiary.
It can create a lot of financial and emotional pain and headache for all parties involved.
Yeah, so you need to check who you wrote down as beneficiary.
That's right, and see if that person is alive, see if you are still married to that person, or if it's a friend or a family member, see if you're still on the same terms where you would still want this person to get the money, which it's probably more money than when you first set the account up, and also ensure the contact information is up to date. Sometimes people set these up for, you know, children or teenagers, their names have changed, the social security number might not be on there from the original one, and they might not have up-to-date information. It makes it very difficult to find the people when they're due to get your money. You also may want to add successor beneficiaries, meaning that you could say, well, I want 100% to go to this person. If this person's not around or can't take the money, I want it then to go to these people, a third, a third, a third. And this is all, you know, relatively inexpensively to do. You can often do it for free, and it takes usually a form or two just to set these up and change them.
Okay, so we find out who it is, and then what?
Well, you might want to think about, especially if you have the IRA or retirement money going to more than one beneficiary, and especially if the beneficiaries are of a vastly different age range, you might want to split them up, because if you leave one IRA account to several different people in different percentages, they have to begin taking required minimum distributions if they're not the spouse. And the RMD, if you will, is calculated based on the life expectancy of the oldest beneficiary, if they're all under one account. So if you split them up, you might say, well, I want half to go to my 40-year-old child, but I want the other half to go to my 10-year-old grandchild. By splitting them up, you make sure that the 10-year-old gets to take it out at his or her life expectancy and won't have to take out so much and won't be taxed so much. And again, you can always change these in the future as long as you're alive, and you still get to maintain control of the accounts even after you split them up.
So is there anything else that we should consider or look at when we're reviewing this aspect?
a lot of older people who have IRAs are in a lower tax bracket, if any tax bracket at all, just by the nature of their situation and living on a fixed income. And their children are 40 or 50 years old and at the peak of their earning years and in a very high tax bracket. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it can be a good financial decision for both generations for the older IRA owner to first convert the money to a Roth IRA, pay what little taxes might be owed on that. Then when the next higher income generation inherits the Roth IRA, they won't have to pay any taxes on the money when they pull it out. And it could save tens of thousands of dollars between the two generations in taxes. Also, we mentioned a couple weeks ago that older people, people over 70 and a half, can give part of their IRA to a charity tax-free, mm-hmm. even if they don't itemize, and that's still good for 2011. But if you have a very large estate and you have a lot of money in an IRA and a lot of money outside of an IRA and you're going to make a big charitable request at your demise, you might want to give the IRA to the charity so that they can pull the money out tax-free and give the non-IRA money to your other human beings and your friends or family who are going to inherit the money, because then it'll cut the overall income taxes that your estate will have to pay.
All right. Sounds good, Kevin. Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. We'll take more calls for Kevin in just a moment. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin, Kurt was listening last week, and he contacted us, and he says, I think you've left out one form of payment that is still an option. We were talking about whether you should charge things or use your debit card or use cash. He says, how about writing a check? I know lots of people will think I'm a dinosaur for still using checks instead of cash, debit cards, or a credit card. I have quit using mine until I have them paid off. And if I'm a dinosaur, I'm probably one of the youngest ones around. I'm only 41. Thanks, he says. Wish I could catch more of the show. Well, Kurt, thank you. What about that? Is Kurt a dinosaur?
Well, if he is, it's probably difficult to write a check because if I remember correctly, most dinosaurs do not have opposable thumbs.
That's
so
right.
I don't know if they can wedge the pen between their, you know, nails or whatever you call it. But now there's a lot to be said for that. Checks are generally more secure, and just because someone has a check of yours, it's not impossible, but it's much more difficult to draw from the account rather than if they were to get a hold of a credit card or a debit card. It is more hassle, which means it may preclude you from spending money that you would not otherwise want to spend if you were using more sound judgment. And it can be better than cash because you don't have to carry around, technically you've got the entire balance of your checking account in your pocket versus, you know, having to carry around several thousand dollars. But many merchants now are not taking checks, partially because of the fraud, partially because of the processing costs, etc. So you might find yourself in a store looking to write a check and they won't take it. So yes, customers still can write checks. It's not a bad idea to do it, but it's not the same as a piece of plastic or straight cash.
Janet in Richland Center is online. Janet, I understand you work at a convenience store.
Yes, I do. And we're told on a regular basis how many millions of dollars it is costing the company to process all of these charge cards. The company I work for gives back part of the profits to the employees, and so it takes it out of my pocket, and they have no problems with checks. And I guess the thing is, I am concerned because small businesses are having to pay these large amounts of money to the charge cards or to the charge companies. And so I personally write out checks because I think it's costing companies way too much money, and I have never come across any place that will not take my check as long as I have proper identification. So I think that it should be encouraged to write out checks and not discouraged. And that's just my opinion. Mm-hmm. And so I'll take your response off the air. Thank you.
Janet, just a second. Janet, are you still there?
Yes,
I am. You're not working at the convenience store counter right now, are you?
No. I promise. I'm not working. No.
I just wanted to make sure everyone was getting their scratch-off tickets and their cartons of menthols. I didn't want them all waiting in line while you made your very valid point, by the way.
But you know what, Janet, okay. When you are working at the store, a lot of I see signs all the time that say no out of state or out of community checks accepted.
Well, we take out of community, but not out of state.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's if you're traveling.
And that's
one
of the great benefits of living in a place like Richland Center is the further you you move towards urban areas, the more even suburban areas, the less likely it is that the establishments will take the checks. But I agree with Janet on several points. I think people should write checks to save the merchants some money, especially small business owners. And as we discussed just a couple weeks ago, cash is the favored currency for small business owners because they get it in their books right away. And yes, you know, there's more potential for loss, I guess, eventually. But the fees, most of these small business owners are running on margins that are so thin, a percentage point or two in fees to process these accounts can eat up almost all of their profit margins. So again, if you really want to do a business owner or a store or any kind of merchant a favor, pay in cash.
Again, thanks very much for that call. We will go shopping around in just a few minutes and talk about one of the most popular gifts that will be given this holiday season. And we will also take more of your questions for Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network.
My mama told me you better shop around. Oh, yeah, you better shop around.
We are going to shop around for computer tablets, and we will and welcome your thoughts and questions about those as well during this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. And Kevin, you have an update for us on what is likely to be one of the most popular gifts given this season.
Yeah, it will be some form of tablet computer. The good people with the Consumer Electronics Association say that a tablet computer will be the second most requested gift this year next to items of clothing. And especially as the tablets are coming out, they're becoming less expensive and more capable, and they're moving more toward content delivery systems than actual, you know, traditional computer systems. The iPad still rules. We talked about the cost and benefits and virtues of the wonderful iPad. About 4 out of 5 tablets sold in the U.S. are iPads. But there are some very good new options that are just being released as we speak, some options for kids. And even people say, you know what, I don't want a tablet. I want to stick with a traditional laptop. There are a few things you need to know about, some events coming up in the next few weeks.
I love options. And what should I keep in mind?
The new e-readers can do a lot more than they used to be able to, and for a lot less money. The Nook from Barnes & Noble just came out, $249, beautiful, elegant, sleek machine. However, it appears that the Kindle, and especially the Kindle Fire, is not only a lower-cost option but offers you better savings on content. There's a bargain version of the Kindle for just $79. The Touch is a little nicer one for $99, and there are a few more models in between. But the Fire, at $199, was the best-selling product at Amazon.com on Friday, one of the best-selling items at Target stores as well. It's full color. You can hold up to 10 movies or 800 songs and 6,000 books. You can browse the web. It has a Wi-Fi connection. They've got a bunch of games and applications as well. And if you really want to save some money by spending some money, you can get the Fire for $199, get Amazon's Prime membership for $79 a year, and then you'll have access to free content, about 5,000 or 6,000 different TV shows, movies, etc., and you'll get free shipping advantages as well. And they've just announced a library lending feature for people who have Amazon Prime, where you can basically check out a book. I think it's one book per month, and keep it for a month on your Kindle Fire with the Amazon Prime.
Wow, that sounds good. What about kids? Isn't there a tablet specifically designed for children?
I've received my iPhone back from my kids after I let them use it, and I'm going to send it down to the lab sometime to identify some of the items and substances that are glued to this thing, making it completely unreadable, which probably says more about my kids than it does about the iPhone. But if you want a tablet for a kid, you know, you can go with the iPod or iPad, and if they're a little older, it's probably worth the investment. But if you don't want to spend that much money, there are a couple different items that have come out. There's a what's known as an InnoTab, which is $79, and the LeapFrog is $99. They're a little more durable than the traditional tablet, and they still have programs designed just for kids, and they don't have an open architecture, so the kids can't get out on the web if you don't want them to do that. some of the drawbacks are they don't have rechargeable batteries inside. You have to use traditional batteries. You can buy an extra AC adapter. But by the time you spend money, and especially with the programs on these, you're probably going to be better off if you trust the kids to handle the tablet responsibly to just to go with a more traditional adult model.
Mm-hmm. And if we're in the market for a laptop, you say the prices are going to be rising?
If you do any word processing or extensive writing on your computer, the tablet's probably going to disappoint you. There are keyboard adapters that you can use, but it's still you have to get the adapter, and it's harder to take it everywhere. So these ultra-light netbooks are probably going to be a better option for people who do a lot of composition on their computer. But because of the floods in Thailand, Thailand is a prime source of some of the components for these very small computers. Prices are expected to rise after the first of the year. So if you are going to get one of those and you're going to get it relatively soon, you may want to get it now, because if you're going to get one of the ultralights, they'll probably be cheaper now, actually, than they will after the first of the year.
All right, time to start shopping. We will take more calls now for Kevin McKinley, and Chris in Jefferson is our next caller. Hi, Chris, you're on the air.
Hi there. My wife and I have two small children, and we're putting away money into their savings account. And, well, savings don't earn a whole heck of a lot. And I was just wondering if there's a better way we could invest that.
These two small children you and your wife have, they're your children, right? You haven't, you know, just abducted kids to an effort to save for their future, Chris?
Correct.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that. Although it'd be very nice. If you are going to kidnap a child, I do recommend you do the honorable thing and start at least saving for that child's financial future going forward. The problem with your situation is you want that money to be safe, but safe investments do not pay anything resembling the interest rates they did maybe 4 or 5 or 10 years ago. Even a 30-year treasury right now pays a little over 3%. A 10-year treasury pays a little over 2%. And CDs pay 1% to 2% going out in the first 5 years. So how old are your children, Chris?
4 and 2.
4 and 2, okay. With that amount of time before they go to college, and if you're comfortable with a little fluctuation in the value, and if you're going to be contributing to this regularly, I would say look at the EdVest account. That's Wisconsin's college savings plan, and you get a small tax break at the state tax level on the money that goes into that. But more importantly, the money grows tax deferred, and then when you pull it out for qualified higher education expenses, it's tax free. And best of all, you and your wife maintain total control over the money. So with a lot of savings accounts in the names of children, we had a caller just last week who said there's a bunch of money in this kid's savings account, and this kid's becoming an adult in age only. I don't want him to get the money. What can I do? And there's really not a whole lot that can be done. So if you are going to save for a child or a grandchild or even a niece or a nephew, the college savings accounts offer you a lot more control and a wider range of options for investments. Keep in mind that much like your 401k plan, if you go with a more aggressive option, you're going to have more volatility and fluctuation in the actual value of the account.
And what happens, Kevin, if a child decides that higher education is not what they want to pursue?
Most of these accounts do not have a sunset provision, meaning they don't say, hey, this kid is 30. Obviously, she's made a complete waste of her life and she's not going on to college. What are you going to do with the money? You can keep it in there, recognizing that people who sometimes go to school later or they go back to school, or you can roll it on to a different family member, generally tax-free, or you can just pull the money out yourself and use it. And even if you use it for something that's not a qualified expense, you do pay taxes on the earnings plus a small penalty, but you only pay the taxes on the earnings portion. Meaning if you put, let's say, $10,000 into the account and it's grown to $12,000 over time and you pull it out and use it to buy a new car, you'd only pay taxes on the $2,000 of earnings and, again, a small penalty. But, again, that's also on the earnings portion as well, so it's relatively small. And you would have paid taxes on the earnings likely anyway, so it's only the penalty that you really get hurt by.
All right. Thanks, Chris, for the call. And Shane in Sheboygan is with us now. Hi, Shane.
Hi.
Yes, what's your question?
I got a three-part question to ask Kevin. The first part is, who does he know that will be a custody to an IRA to be invested into real estate? And the second part would be, can my IRA and my wife's IRA combine to purchase a property? And the third part would be, knowing the property is paying in full, can the equity be rolled over or you know, use it to cover other properties? I take my answer off the air.
Okay. Well, there are a lot of people who purport to be able to do this for you. Some of them reputable, some are not, and I don't know enough about them to say which are which. I will say this. There's a reason that most larger IRA custodians like the Schwabs and Fidelities and Vanguards of the world won't do this, and it's because it can be very complex buying a property that's difficult to value, and also navigating the laws. There are a lot of laws that prevent people saying, well, I'll just buy my house in my IRA, then I can use this money to pay cash for it. Any appreciation is tax-free, or real estate or what have you. Or when you're talking about borrowing money to do that and using the money in the IRA, it's very tricky and very difficult. And even if you get it established correctly, Shane, from the upfront, there are things that can go wrong down the road, even if you've taken every single step. So if you are going to do this, I would find a reputable person who specializes in being a self-directed IRA custodian who handles real estate. I would also have an accountant, a CPA, and an attorney, all of whom are very experienced in dealing with owning real estate inside of an IRA, to make sure that every single year you are doing what needs to be done to make sure you don't run afoul. Because if you have one slip up in doing this, you can poison the whole deal, and all of a sudden you can owe taxes on everything plus penalties. So I'd be very cautious about doing this, and I'd really prefer that you would just stick to CDs, stocks, bonds, and mutual funds in the IRA and purchase your real estate with other money.
Okay, word to the wise. Shane, thanks for the call. I think we have time for this last email from Billy. What do you think of fixed rate annuities? There is a company buying dinners and giving workshops on estate planning, wills, etc., and they are offering fixed rate annuities. So what do you think of that, Kevin?
Well, first of all, buy your own dinner. The $9 or whatever you save on the rubber chicken is not going to be worth the cost that you're going to pay eventually when, not everyone who does this, but certainly many of these providers, we've heard stories in the past on the show here, people sign up, and they seemed really nice, and then once they got my name for the free drawing for the, you know, a 2-liter bottle of Pepsi or whatever, they just hounded me into getting the money into this thing, and it usually is an annuity. And the reason that it's annuity is not because annuities are fantastic or perfect. It's because those investments generally pay a higher level of commission to the salespeople than other mutual funds and certificates of deposit. So it doesn't mean the annuities are bad. It just means you should know that the person is probably motivated more so to sell something like this than they are other types of investments. Annuities do offer lots of features and benefits that aren't available in other types of investments. Fixed rate annuities are basically a loan to the insurance company. And if the insurance company can pay the loan off back to you, it can be a very good investment. But if they're offering at a rate that seems too good to be true, it probably is. And the higher the rate is, the harder it is they're going to have earning that rate, and the more likely it is they're not going to be around to pay that rate in the future. And then you might be out of luck. So they're not bad, but they're not probably as good as the people providing the free dinner and workshop are making them seem.
There we go. Time for the website of the week.
Well, we're trying to keep some places out in front for people who find interesting, useful, and priced conscious gifts. So here's another one, kk.org/cooltools has some awesome items on there for the hard to shop for people in your life. kk.org/cooltools, and we'll put a link up to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
I love awesome too. So four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, will, I think, be back with us next week for another edition of On Your Money. Thanks to Rob Ferret and to Bill Martins for producing this hour. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. Coming up tomorrow between 8 and 9, I'm going to be talking with the author of 18 Minutes about finding focus and overcoming distractions. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.